Welcome to American Security Project. We're really glad to have you here. And we have a very interesting speaker this morning, someone who has made a huge difference in a country that has suffered for a long time, and a place that American interest became apparent during the Cold War, but because East Africa was being played off against, in Lee's opinion, being played off between the Soviets and the United States and the Horn of Africa and the Socotra Anchorage, where the Soviets used an area that they used for their Navy as a rest, recreation, modest recreation, and refit area off the north coast of the Horn of Africa. Was a place that the United States forces focused on a good deal. But my experience as a naval officer largely was that aside from that, we didn't pay a lot of attention to East Africa. We made occasional port calls in Kenya, but Somalia was not really on the map, of course, until the early 90s. The American Security Project is an outfit. Many of you already may know about us, but you have to sit for the commercial anyway. American Security Project is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to helping people understand the security consequences, the national security consequences of a variety of things, some of which are not thought about in the security context often enough. Of course, terrorism and nuclear proliferation are two issues that are generally thought of as national security matters, but other things like American competitiveness, the new energy economy, the way forward on some tough policy choices having to do with climate and industry and the like, those are areas that too seldom are considered to be of national security consequence. And so we get into those areas, which gives us an opportunity to talk from a bipartisan perspective about a very wide range of things that are both interesting and important to the country. The particular topic that we're going to talk about today and that Professor Abdulwali is going to discuss with us is an insider's view of Somalia during recent times, during the reconstruction phase that has gratefully begun in Somalia. When I was last in Mogadishu in 1995, we were withdrawing the United Nations peacekeepers who had replaced the U.S. forces when the Marines left earlier in the decade, and over a period of January, February, March of 1995, the U.S. and Italian Marines, and with the assistance of forces from four other nations, withdrew the Pakistani Brigade and the Bangladesh Battalion, the last remnants of the UN peacekeepers. And at that point, we left Somalia on its own. And we've read since then of the difficulties, the stresses, these conditions that are continually being imposed on the people of Somalia. And we have witnessed the movement into refugee camps in northern Kenya and elsewhere that have taken place as a result. There was a piece this morning on NPR, just as I drove in, where the BBC was reporting from Mogadishu on the reconstruction that's taking place, the general happiness, as the reporter put it, the fact that that people were going about their business. And my hope is that the conference being held in London, also beginning today, convened by the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, that and other international efforts will result in a continued resurgence and rebuilding of Somalia. This is a great country, potentially, with great people. And it's a country where it is extraordinarily important to the United States that the the structure of the government, the strength of governance in East Africa in general be such that people can flourish, that the economies can develop, that the processes of self-selection will work, and the governments will in fact represent their people. So today we have a person who I believe at great professional risk and sometimes at probably personal risk has participated in the beginning of this resurgence or the gaining of traction in this area where it's so important to Somalis, it's so important to us that good things take place. And so I'll ask the Prime Minister to talk with us for a bit and give his perspective on things of this nature, and then we'll have a Q&A period after that. So with that, Mr. Prime Minister.
Thank you, President Bee, for your kind introduction. It's a pleasure to be with you here, and thank you for coming. Today, an important conference is taking place in London to help Somalia regain its statehood. This is a follow-up conference to the first London conference of February 23, 2012. The main purpose of this conference is to galvanize international support for the government and the people of Somalia. Over 55 governments and international organizations will be in attendance. Two other conferences will follow, one in Tokyo, I think in July, and another one in Brussels in September. The later one in Brussels will be about what we call the fragile state principles and the new deal. I will discuss later in detail. If successful, it will help Somalia regain its ability to provide for its populace, the most important aspect of any polity. A polity that cannot deliver will never be a good polity. A lot of progress has been made in the last 18 months, and the international community is quite upbeat about the situation in Somalia. There was a tremendous goodwill both from the international community and the Somali people, and a realization that we have come a full circle, and finally, Somalia will become a useful member of the community of nations. However, the journey to a full recovery will be hard and long. The situation is still fragile, and the peace in Somalia is still very tenuous. Let me come back now to the topic at hand, U.S. national security and the new Somalia. One might ask, why? What's at stake in securing Somalia, and why the U.S. should be involved and care about Somalia? Let me highlight three important elements that I think are the cornerstones of the U.S. involvement in Somalia today. There are many other issues, but I will emphasize these three. The first one is fighting terrorism. Somalia has been the principal source of instability in the Horn of Africa. This instability has a wider and far-reaching security implications for the region and for the global community. Al-Shabaab, Al-Qaeda's franchise in Somalia poses a great threat to U.S. national security, and their elimination is of paramount importance to us. Moreover, we should be cognizant of the fact that the turmoil in Somalia destabilizes not only that country, but the region, and also some aspects of the international community. A secure and peaceful Somalia will deny international terrorism a safe haven in the Horn of Africa. Al-Shabaab is a terrorist organization. However, with American, mainly of Somali descent, personnel, it poses a great national security risk because of over 2 dozen members, including the infamous Abu Mansur al-Amriki, have American passports and can return to the U.S. and potentially commit international terrorist attacks. The U.S. is in a unique position to help defeat al-Shabaab. Besides our military might, we have diplomatic and soft power tools at our disposal in the U.S., and we must effectively use them to help stabilize Somalia. Currently, the Western interest in Somalia, we know, is primarily based on counterterrorism and a concerted effort to deny, to destroy al-Shabaab. This, however, creates an impression that the Western involvement in rebuilding the Somali state is lopsided and quite flawed. This militarized approach to security in Somalia is overly simplistic. The military approach to sidelining Shabaab, however, was successful thus far. Nevertheless, on the basis that there are no plans for any sort of seriously enlarged AMISOM or other forces, and the real current strength of al-Shabaab, we will suggest that an overwhelming political approach must also be considered. Any U.S. policy towards Somalia must take into account the importance of the history, culture, clan, sub-clan relations that have driven the conflict in Somalia for the past 20 years. So we'll suggest a two-track approach. One, rebuild security forces in Somalia, however, negotiate with the moderate elements of al-Shabaab, an approach similar to the peace process in Afghanistan. No doubt, Somalia needs a strong army to secure its borders and counter international security threats, but it cannot be the foundation of an approach to secure Somalia for a couple of reasons. One, in a pragmatic sense, the Somali National Army is too fragmented, lacking in training equipment, and lacking civilian control and funding to be a sustainable security solution. The international support to the army will not be large enough or last for long enough to make it sufficiently strong in the long term to destroy al-Shabaab and control the entire country. Two, in principle, the army cannot leave the approach to securing Somalia unless the strategy being followed is to perpetrate ongoing conflict in the country for years and years to come. It must follow, not lead, a serious political involvement. Therefore, defeating al-Shabaab needs a credible force, but also overtures of reconciliation might be necessary. Some might argue that negotiating with al-Shabaab is a futile exercise. I will, however, suggest that Somalia cannot reach peace through violence. Violence breeds more violence. At the same time, though, we cannot allow others to reach their political ends through violence. I will suggest that a political approach is a more effective way in keeping Shabaab at the margin of the society in Somalia. Already, their nationalist and anti-government narrative gains popularity in some parts of the country. We're not proposing an all-out negotiations with al-Shabaab, but a process of building contacts, relationships, and confidence to split and weaken the movement, using military force to support that process, but not lead it. We need to understand of who al-Shabaab are and are not, how strong they are, what they want to achieve, how they stand in Somali society. Sidelining them as faceless evil international terrorists may benefit some, but not necessarily help Somalia. There must be an alternative approach, and that approach is a political approach based on what's achievable in reality and space in Somalia. Some segments of the Somali society who suffered from historic injustices are susceptible to the ideology of Shabaab. Although most of the Somali people actually have turned against this bloody organization and recently sided with the government, there are still some segments of the society who are still supportive of al-Shabaab. We should also use the soft power of the Somali moderate religious scholars to discredit the religious sway of al-Shabaab and use their extensive experience in de-radicalizing the youth. We need a religious counter-narrative to al-Shabaab's obnoxious but sometimes effective narrative. Killing innocent people in the name of Islam is not sanctioned by any religious edict, but it became a common practice in Somalia. The backbone of al-Shabaab is misguided youth. And once the organization loses its religious legitimacy with the youth, they will easily come out. Once the youth leaves, the federal government, with the help from the international community, can help them reintegrate and become useful members of the Somali society. The second reason that why we care is piracy. Fighting piracy is another US national security priority in Somalia. Somali pirates are a threat to global trade. Over 20,000 ships sail on the Somali coastline every year, and disrupting this vital route is a challenge to globalization and world trade. However, eradicating Somali piracy is as hard as it's desirable. Because of the instability in Somalia, the pirates have operated freely from their harbors, mostly in the north and central Somalia. Although ships from over 25 countries patrol the area, and the maritime law equips naval vessels over the Horn of Africa with the powers of arrest, bringing pirates to justice is frustrating by cost, restrictive rules of engagement, and politics. Hence, 90% of captured pirates are released quickly and without sanction. And the foreign patrol's effectiveness is declining as the pirates move over ever further offshore. Although piracy is recently waning and is in sharp decline, it's still a threat, and quite few ships are still in the hands of the pirates. There are many suggested remedies, but each one has its drawback. Outlawing ransom is neither feasible nor in the hostage's interest. Stationing army guards on vessels or training crews to use firearms will only provoke a more brutal response from the pirates. We have to understand that the piracy epidemic in Somali waters is merely a reflection of the anarchy onshore. Piracy, like terrorism, is reflected by a deeper melee. The root cause behind the mushrooming piracy of the coast of Somalia are state collapse, humanitarian crisis, abject poverty, and the ongoing exploitation of the Somali territorial waters by global factory fishing vessels that left very few viable livelihoods for fishermen in Somalia. Mobilizing the world's navies at considerable cost to stop 40, 50 million piracy problem is penny-wise and pound-foolish. That's how Somali see it. This calls for a truly holistic approach covering the political, security, and humanitarian dimension of piracy. Efforts to prosecute cases of piracy should also include the issue of illegal fishing and toxic waste dumping. The IMO, International Maritime Organization, reported that Somalia lost or loses $400 million to $1 billion every year on illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing off the coast of Somalia. Perpetrators of these crimes are no less guilty than pirates themselves. This leads us to the conclusion that the answer lies onshore rather than offshore. Addressing the root cause of piracy instead of dealing with the symptoms will hopefully make a dent to the piracy problem. Therefore, we suggest a two-track solution also for piracy. First, putting money and effort into training Somali coast guards and constructing courts and prisons in the region. Because it will take decades to rebuild the shattered Somali state, the outside world also must itself engage directly with the regional administrations and help coastal communities build infrastructure and fisheries which have been ravaged by foreign trawlers and the dumping of toxic waste. The European Union, which operates one of the biggest anti-piracy naval forces in the area, says it's committed to a comprehensive approach that combines bringing pirates to justice and helping them find other livelihoods. Actually, now there's some programs by the government of Norway whereby they give vocational training to Somalis in Gambia and also in Puntland. While short-term measures to curb pirate attacks are certainly necessary, the US government will also have a long-term objective of helping Somalia overcome this problem. The third aspect, which I say is very important for the US to be engaged in Somalia, is preventing anarchy and fostering good governance institutions in Somalia. Somalia's problems are the result and the absence of the rule of law and a lack of a coherent central government. Somalia is torn apart by two decades of internal strife, and Somalia's problems can only be solved by Somalis themselves. The U.S. government should help the Somali people establish good governance institutions, predicating on the current process of federalism and engaging all the Somali stakeholders in the federated process. Locally driven governance is widely seen as the only way to bring stable, acceptable government to Somalia. There needs to be a central government which can represent the country internationally, secure borders, but the central government that grows too strong before local administrations can stand up risks destabilizing the country. The current government's view that further debate on the constitution will follow on from the security, that's the argument. We suggest that a serious, committed approach to consulting on the constitution is the best solution to bring security to the country. It's the most important tool for building a united country with agreements on how power is distributed. It's a process that must start soon, quickly. The major debate of that debate and move toward agreement must be about the idea of federalism. And the issue of federalism now is a huge, there's a huge debate in Somalia. Currently, there are tremendous misunderstandings around that word, and it became immensely emotional. The debate must start from simple questions of which level of government spends on what, who controls local security forces, which governments can take in terms of tax and other revenues, how local layers of government form, and what power central government should have. Then you start there to use words to describe the nature of the government, not vice versa. So therefore, people will tell you, we don't want federalism, but we want a unitary, decentralized state. So semantics doesn't matter. What matters is the actual functions of the hierarchical levels, this vertical separation of powers, where you have the federal state and the local government. So the debate of the semantics is became a big issue in Somalia today. The long-term solution for Somalia's conflict is to be found in a political accommodation and reconciliation. It's important for the Somali federal government to reach out to broaden its space as much as possible to bring as many clans, sub-clans, groups, particularly existing and emerging federal states. One of the biggest obstacles toward a peaceful and united Somalia is the secessionist stand of Somaliland. The secessionist stand of Somaliland is hampering the international community's effort in helping Somalia find peace, stability, and full governance. Somaliland can play a vital role in reestablishing governance in Somalia if it ceases to have these secessionist ambitions. Helping establish national governance through regional authorities is the way forward. We welcome the talks between Somaliland and the federal government. We should convince Somaliland that it is better off being with us than being separate from us. When one looks at where governance is established in Somalia, for example, you can look for Puntland and Somaliland, these two regional governments were formulated from the bottom-up approach with many conferences held within their respective territories among key stakeholders. Currently, the Juba province, along with the Gedo province, has combined to form the Jubaland state of Somalia. The U.S. and the international community should support this initiative and encourage the federal government to further federalize the other parties in central Somalia. So once the Somali peninsula is completely federalized, then you can have a conference held with the federal member states representing their constituencies. Through this federal state, member states conference, a new organic, inclusive, and legitimate Somali national government can emerge in 2016. The U.S. government, along with the international community, must press the federal government to establish and encourage federal status throughout Somalia. The international community should actually give incentives to the federal government when they help establish a federal state. The U.S. also and international community must present a carrot and a stick option for Somaliland. The U.S. international community must articulate to Somaliland and should tell them in no uncertain terms that recognition is not an option, so it must become a productive stakeholder in the new Somalia. Finally, one last argument of why we care about Somalia is economic interest in Somalia, the U.S. economic interest in Somalia. Somalia has the longest coastline in Africa and is strategically located along the coastline to the Indian Ocean and the Gulf of Aden, two strategically important waterways. It's also close to the Middle East, a vital region for America's long-term strategic and oil interests. An estimated 1 million barrels of crude oil passes through the Gulf of Aden each day, much of it going to Europe, North America, and American allies in Asia. Given the volatile nature of this region, it's a U.S. The U.S. presence is critical to defend the security and economic interests of its allies and the U.S. itself. Somali has also considered it to have an immense untapped oil and gas reserves. Thus, its economic potential is also huge. What I found out when I was prime minister is that nearly two-thirds of Somalia were allocated to the American oil giants of Conoco, Amoco, Chevron, and Phillips. And most of it was done before the collapse of the state in the late 80s when Siad Barre was overthrown. So America's oil companies are well positioned to pursue Somalia's most promising potential oil reserves once the country is pacified. The U.S. national security interest, therefore, is closely tied to securing fast energy supplies. And that is why, one more time, Somalia is important. Thank you for listening, and I welcome your questions.
Let me kick off the questioning here. It's been a while since there was a U.S. embassy, a full-fledged embassy in Mogadishu.
Sure.
Is it on the way to being reestablished? Is it reestablished? I ought to know that, but
sure.
I don't.
What's good about the relationship between Somalia and the U.S. is U.S. never left Somalia, okay? The relationship went through different levels, but they were always there. You know, there was always one of the Cheryl, one of the ladies who was the deputy to Ambassador Swan, was telling me that although American embassy for Somalia is still now located in Nairobi, but considering the personnel of that embassy, when you compare it to other African countries, is one of the biggest. Okay? Although it is just an office in Nairobi, but they are very much involved. The USAID also was very much involved. Now, since the new political dispensation came into being in September, there's also a renewed engagement to move the embassy to Mogadishu, but not necessarily to Mogadishu, but like the British, you know, in secure areas near the airport, maybe. But there was a huge talk that the international community involved in Somalia was in Nairobi for too long, and we're not really doing much of a good. So therefore, being closer to Somalia was considered a lot. So I don't know when, but hopefully they will move.
Of course.
Yeah.
Questions? Comments? Yes, sir, in the back.
I did a small project for Somaliland, and in communicating with some of the people there and some of the government officials, there was a strong sense that they were neighbors, they were friends, they were family, but they weren't the same country. And I know that's not broadly shared throughout other parts of the region. Mm-hmm. What would be wrong with a plebiscite or referendum for people in Somaliland to decide their own fate, and should regional powers respect the results of that plebiscite, similar to what we saw in Ethiopia?
Somaliland recently, actually they were the drivers of now the talks between the government, the federal government and Somaliland. and when I was their prime minister, actually, we wanted to postpone the meeting to after August elections, back in June, when we met at Somaliland and the TFG met in London. But they were pushing to for the meeting to take place. Reason being, still, what Somaliland now is interested, basically, is amicable divorce. You know, they thought that that would be the easier route. Then, so they still convinced and they still want to secede from Somalia. But the question is, government as a social contract. There are people who are in that Somaliland territory, but they are not. They are not in that project. They are not interested in seceding from Somalia, and that's why you are having this issue between Somaliland and Sol Senac in that area, but also in the outer state and others. So there are others who don't want to secede from Somalia. And so where are you going to stop? This is the issue. It's not like all Somaliland wants to secede from Somalia. And if the question is, which one is legal? Will you say plebiscite or referendum? Will you ask all Somals to vote for that referendum, or you will ask only Somaliland or Somalilanders to vote for that referendum? So this is also a very murky legal issue there. Okay. But as I said, we have to convince Somaliland that they're economically and politically and in every aspect they are better off being with Somalia than being from separate from Somalia. But also, the international community has to push both the federal government and the Somaliland to really come to terms and agreement and make sure, as I said in my speech, to Somaliland that recognition is another option. So therefore, you might as well deal with your kith and kin.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
I just had a question about the recent arms trade embargo lifting and some other partial lifting.
Sure.
And kind of obviously one of the priorities is for Somalia to be able to have its own army in a very good standing army to counter al-Shabaab.
Sure.
But also one of the dangers is those arms go into kind of small, or even Jewish al-Shabaab. What kind of steps is the government taking to ensure that that's not going
to
happen?
Yeah. You know, in reality, the lifting of arms embargo doesn't change much. Because even before that, arms were going to illegally to non-state actors in Somalia, Shabaab and others. But also the government was receiving arms. So once the government asks for an exemption, it was always automatic. It's always given. So this made it a little bit more formal. But the actual reality, it doesn't change much. Those who were receiving arms illegally will always get illegally. But the government also receiving it because once they asked for an exemption, they were granted to get the army. So it is, nothing changes. It is, you know, yeah, make it a little bit more legal for some governments to help Somalia to give, rebuild the Somali army. But the fact of the matter is nothing much have changed since then.
Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you very much. Edward Lucas from American University. Just a quick question about piracy.
Yes.
You mentioned that piracy, piracy has decreased dramatically since 2012, and one of the reasons, at least we see in the popular press for this, is that within the areas where piracy is prevalent in Somalia, there's been a change in the view of the local people, how they view piracy. Mm. I just wondered if you could comment on that. Are those reports accurate?
Yes. Very important question. Actually, the both when it comes to terrorism and piracy, we always miss really the most important aspect, and we haven't used enough our moderate religious scholars. For example, Ayo, which is, used to be an, a pirate by in Budla, which was used to be a piracy hub. There's no more pirates there, just because of one man, one religious scholar who was recently assassinated, Sheikh Abdul Qadir Ka'ami. What he did was, he made life difficult for pirates to telling people that it is not religiously kosher to you know, sell goods to them or give your daughters to them or deal with them, sell houses or whatever. So life became very difficult for them in El, and that's what they did. Then they moved. So we have to use this soft power of religious scholars, even also in Al-Qaeda and Shabab narrative. We fail to use religious scholars to come up with a counter narrative, so therefore telling people that this obnoxious ideology of a Shabab is not the right thing to do. But we really haven't used much of that soft power when it comes both to piracy and also to terrorism. So we have to really use more of that, and that's why we have to engage the local communities and religious scholars, traditional religious scholars and others to take part in that campaign.
Good morning. My name is Abdelhamid Mujal with the State Department. Thank you for hosting us this morning. Thank you, Dr. My first question is the integration of militias,
yes,
like the Raskan Poli and Sunnah al-Jama'ah.
Yes.
Recent report that the government will pay $2 million to Ahl Sunnah Wal Jamaah to be integrated to the Somali army.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you see that? How you see that first?
Yeah.
What's your insight? My second question is about parliament material.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if are you still with the parliament or
I left.
You left.
Yeah.
So you, Dr. Ahmed Sabatar,
yes,
and many of the diaspora,
yeah,
changing the country now, they are out of the parliament.
Sure.
How do you see the parliament now, where
yes,
the majority of the diaspora in the
sure,
out,
sure,
they left, and
sure,
maybe that's, do you think that the spoilers,
sure,
I don't want to name them, if they go back again, they can at least stabilize the country?
Sure. The first question was, I forgot the first question. The Al-Sunnah wa-Jama'ah and Raskan Boni. Sure. Look, as I said in my speech, the Somali army now is too fragmented and wherever you go, there's a clan militia. Okay. Although some of them are the Somali military forces, but you know the ones in Gado is one clan. They was in actually the Juba land group, which was trained by the Kenyans, was also a mixed hazard. Yes, those ones have a national character, but the others are not. The last group that went to Uganda when I was there, 900 of them for training. We also made sure that it was from across the country, and so that the Somali military should have a national character, not a clan character. But we are not there yet. So these militia forces, whether they're in central Somalia, Al-Sunnah, or in Gedo, or Raskan Boni, we needed them because they were really a fighting force. You know, there was, although they are one group or one clan or one religious organization, but they were a cohesive group that really fought against the Shabab or others in Somalia. So we needed them. But we wanted, for example, to be reintegrated into the Somali force so that it makes you have a Somali force that has a national character. For example, before the capture of Kismayo, we proposed that the Raskan Boni group should be integrated to the TFG forces, because you had a TFG forces here fighting, but also you have the Raskan Boni forces, led by Ashraf Ahmed Madobe. But we wanted, before the capture of Ismail, to make sure that these forces are integrated. So we don't want to create warlords, you know, with his own militia here, and another warlord with his own militia there. That process is going on, and we need to do that, because at the end of the day, we need a Somali army that have a, you know, that have a national character, not a clan character. The other topic that you remember, when we were selecting the new parliamentarians, there was a criteria. And we set up a good criteria, actually. One of them was education, that they should have a minimum threshold of education, that they should have no history of warlordism and, you know, and criminality, good moral compass. So we had a good criteria, and we have a technical selection committee to make sure that those who are coming to the parliament should have that, but also to make sure the quota for women, which we set for 30%. But then Somalia is Somalia, and one of the reasons I believe I lost the election was because of fighting these spoilers to come to the parliament and others. So, but at the end of the day, you have to be pragmatic enough in Somalia, and we still have some spoilers in the parliament. But the new parliament is much better than the previous one. Actually, 56% of them are college graduates. And we have 17% females in the parliament, which is a good starting point, because the region, the average in the region is around 12%. So although it's not the parliament that Somali deserves, and the parliament we wanted to come, but it's still a much better parliament than the previous one.
Federalism? Is it a viable structure for Somalia, given the fact that most Somalis know that, and the international community as well knows that it's a deeply rooted clan structure, and given the current situation in the Jubaland region?
Okay. Sure. Very good question. Federalism, as I said, it's semantics. You know, other people say unitary federal state, or a unitary decentralized state, but they don't want the word federalism in it. I'm a big believer of federalism, but that is the personal. But the practical aspect of it, of federalism, the reason a lot of people are advocating for federalism is because a centralized unitary state failed Somalia. We had that before. Eh? In principle, why federalism is good? For example, in the U.S., we are a federal state. Why Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, and Madison were advocating for federalism when they wrote these federalist papers? Simple reason is because the government is the only entity that has monopoly power on violence, and should have monopoly power on violence. So to reduce that violence of the state, okay, the power of the state has to be divided horizontally, where you have the legislative, executive, and the judiciary. But here in America, they said, that's not good enough. The power of the state has to also be vertically divided, where you have the federal, state, and the local. Why that? Because at the end of the day, what's important is the sovereignty of the individual, and we have to protect that. Okay? Why not Somalia? The same thing. Okay? We don't want a strong central government that can, you know, harm people, as happened before in Somalia. That's why you have to. We need a minimum but efficient government, but also the power of the state has to be with the people. You have to devolve the power from the center to the periphery. And will it serve Somalia? Will it be good for Somalia? We don't know. But we haven't tried it yet. Okay? We tried a central state, a strong central government. We tried it before, but it failed. Okay? So now federalism is the law of the land. People agreed on it in 2004, not now, 10 years ago. So we have to, and you know, federalism doesn't have to be based on clan. Okay? why it should be. You can have different clans having this the same federal state. Okay? You can have, for example, some people are advocating, you can have, for example, Hiran, Galgadut, Muduk, having one state, different clans, but people who share common many common things. Okay? It should be based on kinship. It can be based on kinship, but not clan, which are two different things. But we have to try it. We haven't tried it yet. So.
I know there are a lot of Somalis who are returning and starting businesses there. You also mentioned for American companies some of the larger oil projects that are potentially available. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you might just talk a little bit more about some other economic opportunities, whether it's pharma, agribusiness, you know, what do you think would be most attractive for foreign customers?
One of the Somalia is it's a rich country in terms of resources. We have the longest coast in Africa, you know it, but also we are one of the richest in terms of marine resources. That's why you have all this illegal fishing going on off the coast of Somalia. But Somalia has also the highest per capita livestock in the world. Somalia has 9 million acres of arable land. Somalia is potentially have a lot of resources in terms of minerals and also oil. So the country is not, it's a rich country with poor people. Okay? And one of the main reasons is because of, besides instability for the last 20 something years, but also the lack of human capital. You know, as we all know, in growth and development, the most important aspect is human capital. Okay? That's why you have resource-poor countries in East Asia, like Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore, are one of the richest in the world, and that's why you have the one of the richest, most of the richest countries in the world in terms of natural resources are in Africa, in Zaire, in, you know, and they are all basket cases. So we need the human capital to go back, and that's why the retaining diaspora, going back to Somalia, has two positive aspects. One is those, for example, who are in the West, they can take this, democracy, freedom, their exposure to all the good ideals. They can take that back to Somalia, which is very important in terms of institution building, but also bring back also the human capital that left the country for the last 20-something years. We had a huge brain drain, and we need to have people to go back and rebuild. And there are a lot of people who are now going back. And once the country becomes very peaceful, I'm sure Somalia, they have a good entrepreneurial spirit. That's why you have today Somalia, all these, you know, people are very resilient, but also very smart in terms of businesses. And that's why you have now communications and transportation, and like the country, although it failed, but also it was succeeding in so many different ways. Eh? And in terms of even per capita income, Somalia is better than today, even after 20 years of lawless and instability, has higher per capita income of a lot of African countries. So there's a lot of potential for the people to go back and do business, whether it's fishery or agriculture or minerals or oil, and, you know. And a lot of us advocate trade and also FDI, foreign direct investment, instead of aid, because we found out that aid never works and it will never work. Okay? And that's why potentially American businesses and companies coming to Somalia is good for Somalia because of that reason.
Good morning, I'm Scott Morgan. I have a two-part question. First, going back to your time as Prime Minister, how would you rate the role of Amazon? What did they get right? What did they get wrong? And how have they helped rebuild Somalia? And secondly, regarding trade, I mean, having people come in for fisheries or and oil is good, but what about the infrastructure? What is the current state of the infrastructure within Somalia right now?
Very good question. Amazon did a marvelous job, really. They did really. And without Amazon, there would be no government in Somalia, that's for sure. And we are very grateful because they have really lost life and limb, blood and treasure, to save Somalia. I remember when I was there, one day we lost 53 Burundian soldiers. One day. You have to think about that. You know, your son being, you know, dying in Somalia, or my son dying in Burundi. It's very, you know, emotional. And they did. That's what Amazon did. And they did a marvelous job driving Shabab from many parts of the country and doing a good job. But the question is, how long can Amazon be in Somalia? Yeah, how long will it last? And that's why I was proposing, although you can fight Shabab, yeah, and those hardcore elements, because Shabab is not monolithic, one monolithic group, yeah, so you can fight the hardcore groups, but also you have to bring on board others who are misguided. Yeah? You know, so that's why you have to do both at the same time. But also, on the other hand, build the Somali forces, support the Somali military, who should have a national character, and support them. And because they can't be, how long can the Ugandans and the Burundians will be in Somalia? Not that long. They've been there already for 6 years, since 2007. And the time is of the essence. We have to do that. In terms of infrastructure, of course, because of the civil war, a lot of infrastructures has been destroyed in Somalia, mainly roads. We never had railroads and things like that, but the roads and airports are not. During the famine, we found out that only two airports were useful in Somalia, and that was one in Berbera and Mogadishu. The rest, there was no. We couldn't take the relief to where people needed the most because of lack of infrastructure. And of course, one of the bottlenecks in terms of investment and FDI in the future will be lack of infrastructure. And it's something that the central government of Somalia has to deal with it. And we have to make sure that the infrastructure development is a priority. It's a priority for Somalia today. And in 2008, we did a study for the World Bank about this issue of infrastructure problems. In terms of IRRA, internal rates, rate of return, one of the best in the world is Nigeria. Yeah? But people are not investing in Nigeria. Why? Apart from corruption and all that other stuff, one of the main reasons was lack of infrastructure, good infrastructure, though they still relatively better off than Somalia and most of the other African countries.
During the government of your government, and in terms of capturing many parts of the country,
sure.
You see that the difference now, there's a lack of a progress where you can see the only coastal city that's left for Al-Shabaab is
Baraba.
And ironically, it's situated between Manka and Kismayo.
Yes.
So do you see this as an intention? How you see that?
Yeah, we don't see the same speed that the Amazon and other TFG forces were operating and liberating the country. This is still that we don't have. I don't see the same kind of, you know, the liberation, the stabilization. It's not going the way we liked it for us to move. I don't think the long-term stability of Somalia, as I said, should be based not only military solution but also reconciliation, political outreach, and because a lot of people Shabab still has some followers in Somalia, not only in South but also in many other parts of the country. Anybody who feels recent or past injustices sometimes resort to helping Shabab and other rogue elements in Somalia. So there are a lot of complications that we have to really sort out. But at the same time, you know, those who doesn't have Somali agenda at heart, those who are trying to liberate not only Somalia but also liberate infidels from Alaska and, you know, Russia, then those you have to deal militarily with those. They have no other choice. But a lot of reconciliation has to be done. And as I said, this is, as you alluded to, the progress is not as much as we like it to be. And I don't know the reasons. Yeah.